Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest this week grew up in Portland, Oregon, earned a degree in economics from Stanford, an MBA from Stanford Graduate School, and an LLB from Harvard Law School. He's known as the Turnaround Kid and Mr. Fix-It for American industry. He's led numerous companies through financial crisis and or bankruptcies, including Chrysler, Delphi, the Detroit Symphony Orchestra, Bethlehem Steel, and AIG. And since 2018, he's been the chairman of the board of Purdue Pharma. His name, Steve Miller. And I'm Jack Prisula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Prisula. This is Anything Is Possible. And we're talking to Steve Miller, known as the Turnaround Kid. Steve, welcome. An honor to have you.
Thank you, Jack. Glad to be here.
Can you start by talking about growing up in Portland, Oregon, and your mom and your dad, please?
I certainly can. Yes, I was privileged to grow up in Portland, Oregon. Also spent a lot of my childhood down at the Oregon coast town of Bandon, Oregon, which had fishing and lumber industry and so on down there. My father was a lawyer in Portland, and so I got an interest in pursuing a legal career, watching his career. But after going to law school, I figured out I'd be a terrible lawyer. I went, after law school, went to business school, enjoyed business so much more that I pursued a career in business instead of law.
What's the biggest thing you learned from dad, and what's the biggest thing you learned from mom?
From mom, the value of a loving family, and from my dad, the rewards for very hard work, dedication. He worked a lot of Saturdays and Sundays and everything else, and because he was serving his clients first, and that made him a highly successful lawyer.
Steve, God has sent you a lot of angels in your lifetime. One of them early on was your grandfather on your dad's side. You have a love to this day for him. Why?
Well, my granddad operated a sawmill, or two of them, actually, down on the southern Oregon coast. And that's why I spent a lot of my childhood in the sawmills and out in the woods. I worked summers out in the woods. But my grandfather was such a beloved figure in the town. He treated everyone with respect, regardless of their station in life. Good old Dave was how he was referred to in the town. And so I learned the value of respect for all the people that work in enterprises and so on. And that carried me through my career. Respect for the people in the enterprise is what can make you successful.
All right. Speaking of being successful, where did you ever learn your people skills, your negotiating skills, and really the study of psychology?
Well, that's hard to say. As both in my family life and also the role model of my grandfather, having respect for everyone who's doing their job at whatever level. If they're doing their job well and are devoted to it, then if that respect for them will show through and they will respect you in return.
Where did you get your love for numbers?
I was good at arithmetic in school. I was kind of best in my class most of the time. And actually, when I went off to college, I thought I might pursue a major in higher mathematics. But boy, the first semester in college, I took a course in advanced calculus. And the first page of the book was completely filled with all kinds of equations and symbols and so on. And the opening line said, consider the following polynomial, which took the whole rest of the page. I closed the book and decided to go pursue some other career.
And all you had to know about numbers was black ones are good and red ones aren't so good. So,
there we go.
All right. You often refer to the fundamental values with which you were raised. Why so?
Well, just because it did so much to shape my life. And, you know, part of it is, you know, the dedication and hard work in order to succeed at what is in front of you. Respect for the people that you're working with that allows you to get along with them, and you get a lot more done if you have a good working relationship with all the people on your side or on the other side of any business situation that you're in.
All right, we're talking to Steve Miller, and in 1968, he joined a fledgling company by the name of Ford Motor Company, and he toiled there from 68 to 78 in Mexico, Australia, Venezuela. Steve, talk about the Mexico experience first.
Well, the Mexico experience, like the others, was an amazing thing in my career development. And the reason is that by going to another country to a much smaller enterprise than, say, Ford U.S., actually at a lower level in management, you were able to deal daily with people from manufacturing or engineering or sales and marketing, and you got to know the whole business, even though it was a smaller section of the Ford Motor Company. Whereas if I had stayed all that time in Dearborn, you know, I would have been, you know, in finance the whole time and only talking with finance people. So that experience was great on a professional level. In addition, going down to Mexico City with my wife and my three boys, we were able to have just a wonderful personal life, you know, traveling around the country of Mexico, getting to know the people, getting to speak the language a little bit, and so on. And it for my whole family, opened their eyes to the whole world and all the different cultures and how to get along with people, even though they're, you know, maybe a little different than yourself in how they speak and what they think.
We're talking to Steve Miller. When we come back, we're going to ask him about an iconic figure at Ford in those days, Henry the Deuce. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything is Possible on 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything is Possible. I'm Jack Rasula. We're with Steve Miller. And from 1968 to 78, he worked for Ford Motor Company in Mexico, Australia, Venezuela. Never complain, never explain. Famously, Henry the Deuce. A few anecdotes, if you would, about the Deuce.
Okay. Well, first off, during my Ford career, I didn't get to, you know, work with him day by day. He was, of course, the chairman of the board, and I was just a middle manager in finance, and I was overseas where he is most of the time was in Dearborn. But he did come to visit in each of the places that I worked, in Mexico, in Australia, and in Venezuela on brief visits, where then I, you know, got to meet and talk with him. I enjoyed working for a company where a guy with his name on the door and with, you know, with decades and decades of family involvement in the company going all back, all the way back to its founding, you know, was important. And you know, the Deuce, Henry Ford II, was able to look beyond, you know, today's quarterly, you know, earnings things and be more of a visionary and permit the company to grow in ways that perhaps would not be possible in any other company. So I was, you know, proud to be working in a company that he oversaw. We did have him when he would come to visit, you know, we would almost as a management, you know, stop worrying about cars and trucks and instead worrying about all the little details of the visit. And one little anecdote is that we called World Headquarters and got for every restaurant that we might visit. We found out what was his favorite scotch, what was his favorite bourbon, this and that and the other thing, so that we could stock each restaurant with exactly what would he might request on that particular meal. So I walked him up the stairs into the first night visit in one place and said, you know, Mr. Ford, what would you like to drink? And he says, I'd like a ginger ale. And I looked at the bartender, and the bartender said, no tenemos ginger ale, you know. And so for all the best efforts, we failed.
So, all right. Another iconic figure at Ford, Ed Lundy. What made him so special?
Well, Ed Lundy was one of the original, you know, whiz kids, like Bob McNamara and so on, that came at the end of World War II to help Henry Ford resuscitate the company that had been a little bit run down at the time. And that group of whiz kids were, you know, hugely successful. There was R.J. Miller, Ed Lundy and so on. But Ed was the shining star of the finance staff. And he ran it, you know, with, I would say, loving discipline. And he had all these rules of thumb for, you know, the language you had to use. You always used the word present rather than current in describing a, you know, forecast of the business. You know, it's said, you know, current is for electricity. You know, the present forecast is XYZ. And everything about the language. In fact, I walked into his office one time, and he and the vice president controller were debating the uses of which and that, because he wanted perfect English in every communication that came out of finance staff that went to the senior management or Mr. Ford at Ford.
All right, 1979, you follow Lee Iacocca from Ford, Jerry Greenwald. You go to Chrysler. You worked there from 79 to 92. Tell us about the famous, iconic Lee Iacocca.
Well, Iacocca was, yes, he was famous, iconic, and so on. He had been fired by Henry Ford when they didn't quite get along. He ended up, you know, down the street at Chrysler, and Chrysler was, you know, about to go beneath the waves. It just it looked like it was at the end of its rope. There was no choice but to go to Congress and get the Chrysler Loan Guarantee Act. It was for $1.5 billion. Seems like chump change these days, but it was what we needed in order to survive. And so Lee was, you know, leading in that, and he got me involved in a lot of that, and I learned a lot from him. When you would sit with him at the lunch table or something, you know, he would have a, you wanted to copy down kind of every one-liner that he came up with as he would go through, because he could express the most complicated subjects in the most simple language that any man on the street could understand. And that was one of his great strengths, with just, you know, communication. He also was the one who, you know, decided to work for $1 a year when we were under such pressure. So he, you know, helped with, you know, the cash flow and kind of took away the, you know, stigma of executive compensation when a company is in trouble. And those were, you know, tremendous leadership things. He also, one last anecdote about Lee. He set up a bonus system for the executives at Chrysler that was based on, you know, your typical things of financial success and market share gains and this and that and the other thing. But at the bottom was the word quality. If we did not meet the quality improvement objectives in any particular year, all of our bonuses were completely wiped out. And his reason was, we don't make cars that are good enough for the American public. And if we don't fix our quality issues, you know, we will go out of business anyway. So we need to focus on that. And it was successful. The improvements in quality of Chrysler vehicles over time was astounding.
Speaking of quality, Bob Lutz. Tell us about Bob Lutz.
Well, Bob Lutz was, you know, one of my favorite characters in the whole Chrysler story. He had been earlier in his career, you know, with Ford. He'd been with General Motors. He'd been with BMW, and he was available. And so Iacocca was smart enough just to go grab him and put him in charge of our products and the improvement in the, you know, and not only the quality of our products, but the excellence of our products as a result of Bob's contribution was just tremendous. And he was colorful. He could speak, four or five different languages, get along, with people all over the world. And I learned a lot from Bob and enjoyed being partnered with him at Chrysler.
He could fly his own jet. He once said, and I quote him, "When times are good, nearly anyone can lead. When times are bad, you need someone like Steve Miller." All right. Every project that is a corporate rescue mission, walk us through the process, if you will.
Okay, on a corporate rescue mission, I've been involved in many companies that for a whole variety of financial reasons or production reasons or management change reasons or accounting impropriety reasons, whatever, they've gotten into very big trouble. Typically, these are companies that have been around for many, many decades, and they've become a little bit top-heavy and bureaucratic. So one of the things I do going into a company is I spend, I parachute in. I really, haven't studied it to death. You have to have the attitude of a fireman where you don't study the situation for a long time. Instead, just grab a hose and get working at it. But the thing I do when after I've come in is I have one-on-one meals, breakfast or lunch or dinner with each of the, say, top 20 people in the company. And I ask them, so what's wrong with this picture and how can we do better? And I get in that moment in time a lot of ideas as to where the answers might lie. And secondly, I learn a lot about those people and who are the bureaucrats and who are the entrepreneurs. And what I want are the entrepreneurs, those with the energy, creativity, willingness to, break through, tradition that may be holding them back. And it's always been successful. And I give a lot of new responsibility to younger people who maybe are, haven't had as many years as you might like, but I've never been sorry about those promotions and those granting of responsibility. And my lesson from all that is when I go into these companies, I don't need to bring a bunch of outsiders into the company. The talent, the desire, the experience to fix a broken company is already there if you can just give them the right direction and put the right people into positions of key responsibility.
We're talking to Steve Miller. He's Mr. Fix-It for American industry. And I'm Jack Masulin. This is Anything is Possible on 760 WJR. This is Anything is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Prasula, with Steve Miller. And since July of 18, he's been the chairman of the board of Purdue Pharma. Steve, I quote you now. In a number of the situations I've been in, we've had to file Chapter 11 bankruptcy. And that's terrorizing to the people who work in the firm. The thing is won or lost on the day you file. Really?
When you do file for Chapter 11, you have to have some sense of how you're going to get out of the mess. And it's actually an advantage for someone like me coming in. I don't have to spend a lot of time apologizing for how we got into the ditch. I can spend all my time focusing on how we're going to get out of the ditch. But when you go into bankruptcy, you make a lot of decisions right at that moment as you file that may determine whether you can successfully use bankruptcy as the lifesaver to bring the company back. Every company I've gone in, by the way, I ask two questions before I say yes, I'll jump in. One is this company worth saving? In other words, does our economy, our society, our employment base in the country need this company, or is it okay if they just disappear and somebody else take its place? And every situation I've got into, there's a lot of value to be added to our whole economy if this company can get back on its feet. And the second question is, can I add value? And that is there something about my experience that can be helpful in getting this company back on its feet?
Ross Perot was like an Iacocca. He had a lot of great little sayings, you know. Everything is wonderful, 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 talking about the government. But he once said, it's a funny thing about people. Oftentimes when they get successful, they quit doing the very things that made them successful. Why is that?
Well, I don't know. The companies I have seen have gotten, they started going downhill, and then they, you know, did all the wrong things. And they, you know, sometimes you fire all the people who do the work and, you know, get hit more top heavy in your management and so on. I mean, there's for every company I've been involved in, there's a different set of reasons, for why they lost track of where they were going. But it's mostly, you know, companies get very bureaucratic when they are big and successful, and they keep adding, you know, more positions to study this and that instead of being lean and mean. And, one of the things we did at Chrysler and at other companies I've been is, you know, we got lean and mean again in order to survive.
All right, let's talk about Delphi. You went there in July of 2005 through October 2009. You were CEO and executive chairman. You took that through bankruptcy. That was like a walk in the park, I understand.
Well, it not only was, 4 years going through the process, and we spent $500 million on professionals. That's the financial analysts and the lawyers and so on to advise us and help us get through it. But while we were in there, the whole world, you know, was coming tumbling down. The market kept getting soft. Then we had the financial crisis of 2008, where everybody lost confidence and slowed down. Car sales dried up, and of course, you know, two of Detroit's big three, General Motors and Chrysler, also went bankrupt themselves while we were struggling to get out of bankruptcy. So it was just a very difficult period of time for the whole industry, let alone Delphi.
I quote you again, half the world thinks I'm a fireman, and the other half thinks I'm an arsonist. Okay, talk about standing up to politicians, the media, and the unions.
Yeah, well, the biggest thing about the Delphi bankruptcy was labor costs, which had grown to $75 an hour for each hour actually worked. And why was that? Well, you have to account for all the pensions and health care for retired workers. And because we were shrinking our business, the number of retirees kept growing. GM, Delphi had the 30 and out principle, where you could start work at 18, retire at age 48, and still get, you know, a full pension and healthcare benefit going forward. And by the time I came on the scene there, we had as many retired people as active workers, and trying to account for that and accrue for all the expenses of the workers we had was insurmountable. And we were competing with other unionized suppliers who had UAW labor as well as we did, but they were paying about $20 an hour instead of $75 an hour. So it was just, you could not go out and compete for any new business while you had that. And so we had to face up to it. That the union, of course, was very unhappy. They were not only protecting the workforce at Delphi, but they were afraid that if Delphi got concessions and was able to reduce its labor cost, that the lesson would then be applied to, you know, General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler as well. So they were, you know, fighting us not only for what was going on at Delphi, but also for what it might mean to the rest of the auto industry.
We're talking to Steve Miller. His autobiography is entitled The Turnaround Kid: What I Learned Rescuing America's Most Troubled Companies. All right, let's talk about a chapter in your life that was literally a love fest. Saving the Detroit Symphony Orchestra, please.
Okay, the Detroit Symphony Orchestra you know, was I did that as a, you know, volunteer, you know, on nights and Sundays, if you will, while I was vice chairman at Chrysler. And yet I regard the Detroit Symphony Orchestra as one of the, you know, finest examples of, you know, turnaround management. And the I had, you know, a lot of support from many of the, you know, people of Detroit, but we had issues. One, the when I took it over, the conductor had quit to go to another orchestra. The musicians union was on strike. The mayor of Detroit was evicting us from Ford Auditorium because he had a different use in mind for Ford Auditorium. And many of the people in the legislature were unhappy that we did not have a more diversified base of musicians. I went to Lansing to meet with the legislators and said, you know, I understand the historic issue here, but you just have to give me some time and we will work it out. And you'll be proud of this. And we did that. We did hire a great new conductor in Naimi Yarvi, who was just a marketing genius, if you will, and kind of brought a lot of spirit back. We merged the orchestra with the group that was working to save Orchestra Hall. And so we rebuilt Orchestra Hall and brought the orchestra back there. And it's now, you know, part of this whole wonderful complex. The you know, Max Fisher Performing Arts Center, and so, you know, we got a lot done, but it, you know, took the whole community working together, and, you know, it was, as I look back on it, I was it was a great learning experience for me, and one where the result is one I'm extremely proud of.
We're talking to Steve Miller, the Turnaround Kid, and I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on 760 WJR.
Jack Rasula, host of WJR's Anything Is Possible, the weekly radio visit, brings his 15 years of inspirational storytelling to hardcover. With God, anything is possible.
Anything is possible.
15 of Jack's more than 750 tales of defeating odds and achieving the extraordinary. Like Bob Woodruff, whose job covering the war in Iraq nearly cost him his life. And Nick Vujicic, the limbless evangelist who has stunned millions with his message of acceptance and grace. With God, anything is possible. Order now while signed copies are still available at trustinusllc.square.site. That's trustinusllc.square.site. And as Jack says,
make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spohom. I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything Is Possible. We're talking to Steve Miller, the Mr. Fix-It for American industry. Steve, how do you keep your cool when all around you are screaming and threatening murder, etc.? Talk to us about keeping your cool.
Well, there's, I would say, two answers to that. One, you just have to have the self-assurance that I didn't cause this mess. But I'm here going to do everything I can to try and fix it. I've got all these different constituents with different points of view. And if I can get them all onto the same page, we'll be in a better place. And I'm not, you know, I talked earlier about, you know, the issues I had with the United Auto Workers, but I have to look at them. Most of the United Auto Workers that worked for Delphi had started their careers at General Motors and, you know, 20 years prior, on the promise that they would get the General Motors pay and benefits. And when I said, I can't afford that, I don't have the money, I've gone broke, you know, they were very upset. But I do, you know, understand them, as, you know, they are people with families, and they have counted on Delphi being able to honor its commitments. And the fact that we couldn't do it, I didn't blame them for being upset with me, just but said, we are where we are, we got to work this out.
All right, since July of 2018, you've been the chairman of the board of Purdue Pharma,
yep.
The infamous Purdue Pharma, the maker of the opiate drug, OxyContin. Talk about this one.
Well, this, two things. One, this is, as backdrop to what I am doing as chairman, trying to get this company fixed and back on its feet and out of bankruptcy. It is against the background of just an incredible human tragedy from drug overdose. I mean, some of it was due to misuse of prescription pharmaceuticals, but a lot of it, particularly these days, is almost all due to illegal fentanyl or imported heroin and so on. It's a terrible problem, and we are trying to do what we can from our point of view to help America to deal with it. We're taking the company, and we have, you know, we no longer call on doctors. We don't try and push pills. We don't do any advertising. We do make the product because it's a miracle drug for appropriate patients, which would be, you know, say like terminal cancer patients or people who've been in an auto accident and they just need to get through the next few days. Those are good. If they got good doctor care, they're not going to end up in a bad way. They're going to have a great improvement in their life. And those are the ones we're focused on. We have put in systems to try and track every pharmacy that buys our product through distributors. And if we see any big uptick in the order rate, we want to find out why is that? Is this because it's becoming a pill mill? Or is there some legitimate reason, like, you know, changing where their warehouse is or something that would cause them to have a aberration in the rate of prescription orders? So we're doing our can. And then our plan in bankruptcy, which I thought would be finished by now, but isn't quite, is to take all of the assets of this company, plus a contribution from the prior owners, the Sackler family, and make it into a public benefit corporation, an opioid abatement trust. And all of the funds would go to victims of drug abuse, regardless of whether it was our drug or not, and to the states and communities that have suffered so much from the problem of drug addiction. So we're well on our way to, you know, getting this thing fixed as best we can and doing our part to, you know, create and preserve the value that is there, even though it is associated with significant problems over, you know, 5 or 10 years ago.
The numbers are astounding. 600,000 people have filed lawsuits, over $1 billion so far in lawyers alone, claims totaling $140 trillion. How big is a trillion, Steve?
Well, it's beyond my ken as to how big is a trillion. But $140 trillion exceeds the combined GNP of every country on planet Earth. And it just, we don't happen to have it. We're going to do the best we can. But it just, the seriousness of the problem is underscored by the fact that this is, in every way possible, a record breaker of a, difficult bankruptcy case.
All right, let's talk, if you would, about communicating with employees. And let's use two examples. One is the Canadian Justin Trudeau with the truckers, and the other one is the Ukrainian president, the ex-comedian. Talk about the two ways and what's the right way.
Well, I am, fearful for, but very admirous of the president of the Ukraine. I mean, he is, standing his ground, leading his people, and, kind of brings back memories of, Winston Churchill back at the beginning of World War II, when he had to give, spirit to his country to withstand the threatened attacks coming from Adolf Hitler. So that's a good way. The, Justin Trudeau, I only know what I, read about it, but he's got, a whole, segment of his population, the truckers, who are very unhappy about the mandated vaccinations, which goes to the heart of, personal freedoms. And, and he has been treating them, I would say, very badly. Instead of leading, he has been trying to just squash them. And I think that's a political mistake.
I quote you again. I get these jobs because I'm fearless and I'm clueless. All right. You talk about warning signs. Repeatedly missed earnings, lack of candor, firing of bearers of bad news, lack of healthy internal debate. Please.
Yeah. Well, that's that goes to, you know, leadership characteristics in companies that do get into trouble. Some of the leaders who have been failures, you know, they are so strong and so self-assured in what they think is right that they are unable to listen. And if anyone gets close to threatening them or looks like a logical successor down the road, they want to kill them off in order to make sure that the board has no choice but to keep them on for a while. And that's just not a good thing for a business. And I would say businesses over time need changes of leadership. Going back to the example of Detroit Symphony we were talking about, when we would have a change of conductor, that would be good, because at the time I took it over, Gunter Herbig had done a fabulous job of getting the orchestra to be very disciplined in the way they played. But when Nami Yarvi came in, he instead led them with heart and put a lot of enthusiasm into what they were doing. So they had the discipline taught them by one leader and had the heart, if you will, the musicality brought to them by the next conductor. And, you know, the combination works well. And I think in every corporation, you can't have one person, you know, lead the business, you know, for decades, because pretty soon the organization has gotten all the benefit of that leader's strengths, but is now lacking some other attributes that a new leader could bring.
Steve Miller, you are a shining example of so many of these traits you talk about. Quality, honesty, having a heart, being good to people. Your grandfather's looking down and saying, that's my little Stevie. Keep him proud every day, Steve.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us. Please join us next Saturday. Until then, I'm Jack Pasula. Thanks for listening, and make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spoken.
Believe in yourself.